Today's scripture reading is Revelation 17, 1 through 6. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. The word of God for the people of God.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've kind of been in a mini-series in the midst of the book of Revelation. And in the midst of that, we're kind of looking at pretty clearly Satan and his allies and what they're kind of up to on the earth back in John's day and even to this day. So we looked at the great dragon, the great red dragon, who is who? Satan or the devil. And it's pretty clear in that passage as to who he is and what he's about. Basically, he's set himself against those who obey the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And that is what the great dragon is all about. So if you obey the commandments of God and if you hold to the testimony of Jesus, you have an adversary. Then last week, we saw how the great dragon wages war against the saints through two of his three allies, two great beasts who work along with the dragon. I spoke a bit about our identity. Who are we marked by? Are we marked by God or are we marked by evil? And we talked a bit about that. So today now, we're going to look at the third ally of the dragon. There were two beasts, and now we're going to look at the great prostitute of Revelation 17 and 18. Again, it's descriptive language, but even the image of a prostitute is going to speak to us, I think, pretty clearly here this morning. In Revelation 17, John is taken into a wilderness where he sees a woman riding on the beast from the sea. This image also has seven heads and 10 horns, which seem to indicate that we're still talking about the Roman Empire. I would argue it's the same beast that came out of the sea. If you read it, they're very similar, all right? And on the beast is a prostitute who represents the ultimate in Roman materialism. And we'll see how this plays out here in just a few moments. John also tells us that she was drunk with the blood of the saints. And as the passage unfolds, I would suggest, as I already did, that this woman symbolizes the city of Rome and its dominion over what they perceived to be all the known world. Now, we know there was a lot more world out there, but they had felt they'd kind of conquered their known world. She rides on the beast with seven heads, which represents seven kings and seven hills, which, again, from the way I understand the book, clearly represents the seven hills of Rome. Rome was built on seven hills. And as I've mentioned, John's word pictures often work in much the same way as modern political cartoons, right? I tried to give a pretty clear reference to that last week. Thank you for not giving me grief. Those of you that may have wanted to do so, it was not about the person depicted, but about how political cartoons communicate a message and how difficult it would be to understand that 2,000 years from now. So, in Revelation 17, I would suggest that John is using what I would call a template that is based on standard Roman imagery, and I'm going to show you this here. And this is a good example of this template. This is a Roman coin, and it says Roma, right? The goddess Roma, who represents Rome. And what is she sitting on here? Seven hills, okay? She's got seven hills, and she's holding actually a sword in her hand, and she's all calm and reposed, right? Like they're at peace. To the Romans, the sword actually represented peace. They called it the Pax Romana, all right, the peace of Rome, that by might and by conquering and by force, They had established peace in the world basically through intimidation and fear, right? I mean, they kept everything in order. So here is how Rome sees itself. Are you getting this? This is clearly how they see themselves. It's an image on their coin that Rome is this calm, beautiful woman who is, you know, has the sword, but she's relaxed now and she's just kind of there. There's actually a lion on there, which is how they kind of, I think they saw themselves again as conquerors, but here sitting on these seven hills. So take that image now and see what John does to it. John turns this image into the image of a debauched prostitute. Instead of sitting calmly on the seven hills of Rome, John's version of Roma rides on a beast with seven heads. She no longer holds a sword gracefully in her hand, but a goblet full of blood. And she is drunk. She is not calmly sitting on the seven hills. What I would argue again is that John is taking the image that Rome had of itself, but he's showing us what Rome is really like. He's showing us what's really going on in Rome. And so I find it also interesting that John changes the woman's name from Roma to Babylon to reveal something about her character. So I think that by giving her this name, it's a way of saying that Roman society had the traits of Babylon. You think about Babylon. Babylon was the capital of an empire that was remembered for its brutal conquests and its destruction of the temple at Jerusalem. That's what it did. Babylon came and did the same thing that Rome did. In fact, the writer of Revelation is very aware, obviously, again, who destroyed the temple in 70 AD? The Romans did. So that same spirit of destruction is being exhibited through Rome, much in the same way that it was exhibited through Babylon. So as we consider the vision, there's two elements that stand out, at least to me. The first element is one of consumption. If you read through the passage and you see Rome, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, was consuming goods from all over, the known world. They were a consumer-oriented society. They were gobbling up so much around them, and that was kind of that attitude. So you see this here. She's consuming alcohol. She's drunk on the blood of the saints, which also is a depiction of violence. So consumerism and violence, I think, is what John is highlighting here that the empire is engaged in. So the harlot is obviously obsessed with displays of wealth. When you see her description, I don't have it right before me, but it talked about she's bejeweled, right? She's got jewels and all this fancy clothes and all this stuff that she's wearing. So I think John's depiction of her stands as part of his critique of the craving for luxury and opulence in Roman society. Now, one great example of this, you can actually find this again historically speaking. So it's just interesting to me, people from that time period. So in his Natural History, which was written between 77 and 79 AD, Pliny the Elder lamented the financial drain from the Roman economy to purchase silk and other luxury items. He remarked that Rome's, and forgive me, but this is his words, that Rome's womankind and the purchase of luxury goods from India, Arabia, and the Ceres of the Far East cost the empire nearly 100 million sesterces per year. Now, we don't really know what that amount is, but we're talking in our day probably hundreds of millions of dollars that was being drained out of Rome and going to all these other places, which makes sense when later, with her destruction, who is bemoaning the destruction of this great prostitute? It's the merchants from all over the world. Why are they sad that Babylon's going down? Because they're going to lose a lot of money, all right? They did not want to see the fall. They were enjoying what was going on in Rome and were making huge financial profits off of it. Beyond the concerns that the import of silk caused a huge outflow of wealth, there's another writer, Seneca the Elder, and he wrote this. Again, just it's a little before Revelation's time, but this is what he says. He says, it's pretty descriptive, but you know, bear with me. I can see clothes of silk, if materials that do not hide the body, nor even one's decency, can be called clothes. Wretched flocks of maids labor so that the adulteress be visible through her thin dress, so that her husband has no more acquaintance than any outsider or foreigner with his wife's body. So what's he lamenting? He's lamenting the decadence, the absolute debauchery that is going on in the Roman Empire, and this craving for silk, and the cost became so great that Rome outlawed men from wearing silk. They couldn't wear silk. There was too much going on. Ah, funny, they let the women still wear it. So anyway, I'll let you figure that one out. But, you know, so but the whole scene, the silk is a very fine and thin, luxurious type of fabric. Thank you very much. And it definitely left nothing hidden from the eyes. And so what I'm trying to say is, you know, if you go back to the image, it's not up there anymore, but of that, the prostitute, the riding on the beast, you can kind of get this sense, even from Romans themselves. There were some Romans that recognized, this is not good. This is not good. There's too much money going out. There's not enough coming in. It's contributing to decadence of all kinds. You know, it's a crazy situation. So is it any wonder that John likens the Roman Empire and its lust for wealth to a great prostitute? Revelation also focuses on the kind of violence that had been experienced by Christians at Rome. Rome was drunk on the blood of the saints. This is a clear, I think, reference to Nero's persecution of the Christians. Now, you can go back and read all this stuff for yourself. It's all historical knowledge that Nero, they're not sure, but many believe that Nero himself set a fire in Rome because he wanted to clear space for a project, for something that he wanted to build. And that fire was devastating. It got out of control, and it burned a huge portion of Rome down. It was a tragedy. It was a huge issue at the time. You know who Nero blamed for the fire? He blamed Christians. You know what Nero did to the Christians in Rome? He hung them up on crosses, covered them in oil, and lit them on fire. That's what Rome drunk on the what? The blood of the saints. Okay, so you can go back and read your history books and see, again, it's not, we don't know for sure who set the fire, but we do know that Nero blamed Christians and they became the scapegoat and he killed many of them during the course of that time. Nero, by the way, who was a very charismatic figure, as I mentioned a couple week or two ago, and there were some who loved his leadership, actually. He was very charismatic and very, you know, actually did a lot of, I guess, good for Rome, but as he, in his later years, it was evident that he was essentially going insane. I mean, he just was doing some pretty crazy stuff. But I also find it interesting that materialism and violence here in this passage, they are linked to the image of a prostitute, a supposedly seductive figure, right? I mean, again, she's dressed and she's got, you know, and this whole image, again, I know we're in church, but I mean, there is this allure, right? There's this seductiveness to this. And I would argue that that allure is still happening today. I'm going to make some stronger applications to today. But materialism is very alluring. It's seductive in nature. The need and the desire for more. We want more stuff. And you don't have to be rich to fall under the allure of materialism. The longing, I've got to have this. Oh, I need that. There's a sense that even for some of power and prestige, a thrill from buying and owning expensive things. And we see this, don't we? But it never satisfies. No matter how much you have, you always want more. But it's that allure that's there. Listen, I'm not going to stand here and say, oh, I'm never tempted by materialism. You know, I never have desire. No, it is alluring. Those things that we want, you know, and the things we wish we had. And I'm not saying that you're supposed to all become monks and go live in a cave. What I am saying is that there is a balance and a rightness to life. I'll come to some things more relevant to us a little bit later. So I'm not saying, you know, don't own a home or don't, you know, buy clothes or whatever. But there's a point where it just goes over the top. You know, and if we would consider, I'm still getting ahead of myself, if we would consider how much we have in relationship even to the most of the rest of the world, you know, maybe we'd give away a few of those cloth items or something. So again, I'm a little ahead of myself, but my point is, it's a powerful allure. It can be seductive. And you know, the other thing that's seductive in its own way is actually violence. As long as it doesn't become personal, think of the movies that we watch. Think of how the popularity of MMA, is that what it is, MMA? I'm telling you, now this is where I get into trouble, because this is a very personal example. I can't watch MMA. You want to know why? Because there's two people just trying to beat the living daylights out of each other. But there's an allure to it, isn't there? You know, MMA comes on and, well, I've only seen it online, but you know, you come across something and it's like, there's an allure to violence. You know, yeah. You know, I wrestle, and this is a tough one for me, but what's the most popular sport in America today? It's football. You know, and I like football. But I got this interesting relationship to football because I'm struggling with the reality. Football is violent. And sometimes we'll watch it over and over again. We'll see like guys, you know, like Joe Theismann, this is a long time ago now, when his leg got broken, you know, and it, like it snaps in two and they're just playing it over and over again. We're like, whoa, man, oh, look at that thing. Rewind. Oh, man, look at that thing, you know, look at that. Yesterday, I saw a college player that got hit, and his head just went like this, just a brief little clip, you know, and they showed it over and over and over again. He was okay. Well, I hope he's okay. But my point is, and now I talked about football, man, all the guys, you all checked out. You're like back there eating. You're already back after the service eating the food. Listen, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm probably going to watch football. My point is, there's an allure to violence as well. There's something about it, especially if it's not personal, that we just kind of get drawn to. And so the purpose of John's picture of the prostitute, I believe, is to startle the readers into seeing the seductive qualities of materialism and brutality, and then to change their perspective so that what might appear alluring turns out to be repulsive. Because if we look at the prostitute closely, in Revelation 17 and 18, she's repulsive. She is slobbering drunk on the blood of the saints. That is repulsive. So John is trying to help us see things for what they really are. He appeals to the seven churches to resist these forces, to chart a different course that's based on different values. The grotesque image of the prostitute is designed to challenge the perceptions of readers who thought that going along with the values of the imperial culture was perfectly acceptable. By creating this picture, John urges his readers to look beneath the surface and see the destructive currents at work in Roman society. And again, getting ahead of myself, I would clearly argue are here today in America. So up to this point in the vision, we see Imperial Rome as a prostitute who rides along in a drunken stupor on the back of the imperial beast. But now he kind of switches to the future. And essentially what John does here is he writes an obituary. He writes an obituary for a nation that hasn't yet died. But he's showing where that empire is going. And he says this in Revelation 17, 15 through 18. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." Sorry, I got ahead of myself. This isn't quite yet the funeral dirge that he goes into. But this scene offers one of Revelation's, the one I just read about there, offers one of Revelation's most pointed comments about the nature of evil. It is inherently self-destructive. it's amazing. If we look back, evil eventually ends up destroying itself. That's what it does. I mean, if you look at this image, who kills the prostitute? The beast. And who is the prostitute serving, ultimately? The beast. Right? Working together with the beast in the service of the great dragon. And yet, evil has a tendency to turn in on itself and destroy itself. And actually, if we look in reality, I'm listening to a book called The Second Mountain. In it, he talks about this cycle that happens in cultures, you know. And one of it is, he didn't say it this way, but evil eventually just catches up to itself and it destroys itself, and something new has to rise out of that. So now to the funeral, or to the obituary. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird, for all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. And all of Revelation 18, I'm just reading the beginning of it, really the whole rest of the chapter is an obituary for Rome, really. Special attention is given to the merchants, which I talked about before. They're grieving the loss of the huge profits they made by selling their goods to the city. But what really matters to them? Is it the people? No, it's just the money. Showing again, like we do in America, America can commodify anything. We can take anything and turn it into a profit, and we're proud of it, you know? So there are eerie similarities here. As the merchants speak, they reflect a worldview in which everything has been turned into a commodity. They rattle off an incredible list of goods they could sell to Babylon as a hefty profit. Part of the problem is that part of that hefty profit came through the commodification of people. Because in Rome, and there's different figures for this, but up to 90% of the Roman Empire, those who lived there, were slaves to 10 to 20% of the population. The commodification of people is where this all goes. When we are in a mad dash of lustful consumption, we commodify everything and we will commodify people. And I will get to that again in just a moment. Modern scholars looking at this list note that it depicts Rome as relentlessly gobbling up everything the world has to offer. Gold, silver, and then eventually even slaves. Everything is just a commodity to be consumed. At the time of Revelation's writing, Roman society was still very much alive. But John writes this strange obituary of Rome to startle his readers into understanding how their society's legacy was going to end. How's our legacy going to end? Well, currently right now, I think we could almost write the same obituary, quite frankly, for the United States of America. The 19th century inventor of dynamite, his name was Alfred Nobel. He actually had the strange experience of reading his own obituary. His brother had died, but the newspapers mistakenly thought that he had died. So they wrote an obituary for Alfred Nobel. And you know what the title of the article was? The Merchant of Death is Dead. Because what did he create? Dynamite. The Merchant of Death is Dead. And as he read it, they basically spoke of his legacy as one of wealth and violence. This reading of the obituary, of his own obituary, so shocked him that he committed his life. He changed his life. He said, I do not want that to be my legacy. So what did this Frank Nobel, what did he create? The Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Prize in Science, Medicine, and Literature. He read his own obituary, and he was shocked by what he saw, and he took a different route. John is communicating to the Roman world, specifically to the Christians in the Roman world, and he is giving them an opportunity to read their own obituary. What are you going to do? I mean, the shock value if we grasp it, is intense. See, you see wealth and luxury and opulence and ease. But let me tell you what your legacy is going to be. And it's intended. Revelation, the whole entire book, has shock value for those that have ears to hear and listen to what the Spirit is saying. So Revelation's obituary of Babylon is meant to have a similar effect. So having said all this, what does this mean to us today? I mean, John was clearly writing, once again, to who? The seven churches in Asia Minor. As we seek to understand what John was saying to those seven churches and understand the literary style that he had taken to do so, I believe it gives us much to ponder today. And I've already leaked out, half of my application through the message. Again, the vision points to the seductive quality of wealth and what it means to be part of a culture of consumption. It also recognizes the fact that violence can be both alluring and mind-numbing. I mean, I don't want to get into this. It wasn't really part of my plan, but how do we get to the place where three middle teenagers, 15, 16 years old, just walk up to a man and kill him right here in St. John's, two, three streets down from here? How does that happen? Violence is mind-numbing. And when we're exposed to ongoing violence, it creates more violence. So personally for me, and listen, I'm grateful to live in the United States. I really am. I know that even statistically, a lot of our younger people, the numbers of those who are proud to be an American, I understand those numbers have gone way down. I still want to say I'm grateful that, I could have been born anywhere in the world, and hopefully I would have been grateful wherever I was born, but I'm grateful. But I'm not blind. America, the United States, you and I are faced with some serious, serious questions and issues. I see a lot of younger people asking the right questions and concerned about the right things, but my heart is broken how they do not see how Jesus and the gospel can answer and resolve some of those issues. For me personally, in my own experience, I see a lot of depression and hopelessness. But I think they're recognizing the right problems, though. I think a lot of our younger people, I'm older, younger meaning probably anybody under 40, asking really good questions and concerned about real legitimate things. They see a lot of what's being talked about here in Revelation. They didn't get it from Revelation, but they see the problem. My heart breaks that we as the church and somehow the gospel of Jesus is not effectively communicating and speaking to the young people that God is concerned about those things as well. So much so that we have an entire book, the final book of the Bible, addresses political, religious, and economic evil and calls on the people of God to do something about it. So the similarities to me of the great prostitute of Revelation in the United States are startling. Just give me a few more moments to throw a few things out here. America has 5% of the world's population, but we consume 24% of the world's energy. We also produce 40% of the world's waste. 5% of the population in the world produces 40% of the world's waste. Again, you can find these statistics. I can point you there to them if you don't believe me. We also eat 815 million calories a day in America, which, sorry, 815 billion calories of food. I have my own struggles with this one. But this is the point. That's roughly 200 billion more calories than we need. So Americans, as a general rule, I'm obviously kind of in this camp, we eat almost 25% more food every day than what we need. That would be enough to feed 80 million people, around the world where people are actually starving. And we throw out, this was unbelievable to me, and I saw a little example of this yesterday. Americans throw out 200,000 tons of edible food every day. 200,000 tons of edible food every day. Now, why am I saying this? You came to church, you wanted to be encouraged and made happy. Well, Revelation doesn't really give us that opportunity too much. It gives us a lot of hope for the future. But the reality is, we are living and functioning just like the great prostitute of Revelation. We've commodified everything, including people, and we are consuming the world's resources at an unprecedented rate. We throw away way too much. We lust for material things and treat people as something to be used for our own advancement, pleasure, and gratification. We spend more money on clothes per capita than any nation in the world. And just to bring it home, and I didn't plan this, actually I didn't even think about Advent conspiracy until I saw this statistic right here. And I've kind of shared it in the past, similar numbers. For 2019, that's this year, industry experts expect the average American to spend $920 per person on holiday gifts, for a total of more than $1 trillion in holiday spending. Now, I'm not sure how they come to that figure. I don't know that it's all just, well, it says on holiday gifts. I have the link for that if you want to go look at that whole scenario. But this is what I want to propose to you. This is where I want to turn this into something a little bit more positive. Do you realize that if America as a whole, if everybody in the country reduced their Christmas or holiday spending by just 1%, in other words, instead of spending $920, you spent $910, essentially. You saved $9.20, just 1%. And if every person in America did that, we would raise over $10 billion. And do you know what $10 billion could do? It could solve the world's water problems in the entire world, so they figure. That with $10 billion, every person in the world could have access to clean water, which is a huge issue, by the way. And there's people dying of diseases and all kinds of stuff because they go drink from the same water that they wash their clothes in and do everything else in. I'll end more on a positive note, but I have to say this. The objectification of people for our own sexual gratification is exemplified in the high rate of pornography that is viewed on the internet. By the way, do we ever stop to think that those are real people? That that's somebody's daughter? Somebody's son? And you know, we're familiar with this being a problem with men, and it is. But recently, a study showed that 1/3 of all internet porn users are women. 1/3. We have a problem. We have a serious problem. The spirit of the Babylonian prostitute is alive and well in America. And you're all here saying, I am so glad I came to church today. But you know what? I'll be honest with you. Maybe this is why we don't have thousands of people coming to Grace. I'm not here just to pat you on the back and tell you that, you know, if you just think positive thoughts that everything's going to be good. As best I can and as I understand the scriptures and the word of God, I'm here trying to share with you truth. And I think this matters. And to be quite frank with you, so do probably 90% of everybody under the age of 40. But for some reason in the church, we just don't want to talk a lot about these things. But they're realities that are before us. And lives are being destroyed and ruined because we have commodified people and things, and we have this insatiable lust for more. In Revelation, the churches are not simply to go with the flow of imperial consumer culture. Listen to what John says, and I'm getting really close to wrapping this up. I appreciate your patience. John says, come out of her. Actually, it's God appealing here. Come out of her, my people. Come out of what? Come out of Babylon. But it's not asking you to go somewhere else physically. It's asking you to come out from under the spell of consumerism and violence, the spell of economic injustice, the spell of the commodification of everything, the allure of violence. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. These things will not go on forever. God is too loving and too just to allow the ongoing commodification, especially of people. This is a clear call to us today that we need to reject the destructive patterns of unmitigated consumption that lead to violence and, again, the commodification of people. We're to base our lives on kingdom values. I'll just put one simple one out here, and then I'm going to give you the most practical application. It fell right into my lap. I wasn't even planning to do this. But the first thing that I would just say, what's a kingdom value that I would share with you today is this. If you have two jackets, share one of them with the person that has none. You want to break the power of consumption and materialism in your life? Take what you have and give it away. You know who some of the most giving people that I know are? They're the people that have almost nothing. It's amazing. It's like they know. You know, it's the story of the woman who got barely enough rice to feed her family, but met another woman who had nothing and still cut her rice in half so they both could at least have something. But things like that happen all the time. But you know what the people that give the least are? The wealthy. Those that have the most to give. And just to make this clear, a number of us in this room, whether you think about it or not, you actually fit into the wealthy category. I'm just telling you, you got more than a couple pairs of pants and a couple pairs of shoes and a couple shirts. And you're wealthy. Because you got more than probably 75% of the world's population does. I would argue that we counter the spirit of materialism through giving. What I'm not going to do now is utilize that message to say, just give me $100 so I can go drive my new car. I'm not going to do that. I am going to challenge you, though. We have this Advent coming up. We've already presented to you the opportunity to spend less on stuff that doesn't really matter and to give more so that we can do what with that? Give it away. Okay? So we're not looking for something for ourselves, but I am going to invite you. This very message, it's like it came to the end. I said, this is so clear. This is the clearest application I could possibly have. Take what you have. Let's give to Room at the Inn. I'd love to send Room at the Inn $5,000, you know, whatever we have. Our goal is $1,000, but that's going to go to people. And when you'll see on this video, that ministry is making a difference in the lives of people without homes in the Salem area. Lives are being changed. People are being helped and assisted through the process of finding their way off the streets. So that's a $1,000 goal that we set. And then we have another $1,000 goal to help right close, right here in our own neighborhood, to help 10 families, again, who've been identified at George Middle School as having the greatest need, financial need. And trust me, we can all contribute to this. You know, it doesn't need to be $1,000,000. It might just be five. It might just be going out and buying some baskets that we can put all the stuff in for George. I don't know what it is for you. But all I'm telling you is that giving of ourselves personally and of our resources is one of the best ways to counteract this spirit of Babylon. The spirit of just mine, more and more. I've tried to give you something practical to apply, but I think the message is pretty clear today. I think it's clear. Challenges me. Revelation, as I've said, has challenged me more than I've been challenged in a long time, I just feel like. It's just like cutting me to the quick on some things that mean a lot to me. So, Lord, I'm just going to pray, because this isn't even about Advent conspiracy. That's just a nice, easy application. Because, and God, I'm kind of praying this to you, but I think I'm saying it also to the congregation, because I think we have a tendency to hear something like this and then we'll give towards something like Advent conspiracy, but we don't really make any really lasting change in our lives. Lord, I'm asking you, I'm asking it for myself, but I ask it for all the congregation. Transform us, Lord. We hear the call to come out, to be different, to take some stands, or to live in very practical ways in our own lives where we're not engaging in the spirit of Babylon. We're not commodifying people for our own pleasure. We're not just buying the next new thing, the next new iPhone. But God, we're looking to you, and we want to, I think you want to bless people. But with that blessing, Lord, we are blessed, and we want to give from our blessing to others. We want to counter the spirit of materialism and violence in our culture. So maybe today there's something that, maybe a specific thing that you've just felt the Lord kind of challenging you in. And I don't know what it is, but you do. And during the worship time today, and again, you don't have to do this, but I'd encourage you just to come forward, and no one's going to judge you, you know, wonder what it is that you're dealing with. We'll rejoice with you that God has spoken to your heart. You could just kneel at the altar or stand, or you could just reach over next, you know, to the person next to you and just say, would you pray with me? This is kind of what God is doing in my life. This is something that I'm struggling with. This is something that I'd like a breakthrough for. But let's take this time to respond to God. Because I believe with all my heart that God can take even a weak vessel like myself and still say something. That he takes his word and brings it to life. So let's not just run up and, you know, or just get up and run out the door. In the context of worship, let's think about these things.